that. So in path integral, we define something called transition amplitude by using a covariant path integral. And this is the summing over Heath series of three geometries. So the suppose there's a four manifold with boundary spatial slice, which is spatial geometry, ingoing spatial geometry, and outgoing spatial geometry. And the history of three geometry is given by this four metric. So the summing over history of three geometry is just the summing over all the four metric here. And to adapt this framework in loop quantum gravity, so we need to know that in loop quantum gravity, the three geometry is quantized. To describe a quantum three geometry, we need the so-called, the spin network state. And the spin network state is described by three types of data. So first of all, there's a graph with number of nodes and links. And secondly, there's a number of spins, as the spins associated with the links. And also there's an intertwiner associated with the vertices of the nodes. And more precisely, the spins is the irreducible representation of SU2. And the intertwiner is some invariant tensor of some a bunch of representation spaces. OK, so I mean, one can also define in loop quantum gravity the Hilbert space, and which is some union of graph Hilbert space modulo some equivalent class. This graph Hilbert space, for example, for this type of graph, and it's given by SU2 to the number L2 space over SU2 to the number of link, and SU2 to the number of nodes, modulo SU2 to the number of nodes. And the physical picture for this three geometry is like the spin network states is describing the quanta of three geometry. More specifically, on the nodes, it carries quanta of space volume with quantum number, which is intertwiner. And on the link, it carries the quanta of area with quantum number given by the spins. And here is the simplest spectra of area of volume predicted by loop quantum gravity. And here we can adapt this framework to path integral. And recall that we need to sum over the history of three geometry. And now the three geometry are given by spin networks, so which means we need to sum over the history of spin network, which is spin form. And here it is the spin form, and with some incoming three geometry, incoming spin network and outgoing spin network, and it's given by this object. And from that, we can compute something called spin form amplitude, which is the number, and depend on three type of data. First of all, there's called a complex, and it's called two complexes, this type of object. I will define more precisely later. And also, there's the boundary data, which is boundary three geometry, the incoming spin network, outgoing spin network. And there are many people working on this object, and the research area is pretty active now. OK, let's give some formal definition of this spin form amplitude. So what is the spin form? A spin form is given by three types of data. And first of all, there's a two complex. So this is a two complex. And more precisely, a two complex has a number of oriented faces, a number of oriented edges, and a number of vertices. So for example, here there are only two vertices in this simple complex. And then to each, so these three types of data gives a two complex. And for each oriented face, we assign SU2 spin. And to each oriented edge, we assign SU2 intertwiner. So that's called a spin form. So to each, then to compute spin form amplitude to each vertex, we have a vertex, something called vertex amplitude, which is the number depending on the data, spin, and intertwiner. And it's called vertex amplitude. And then what we need to do is just like recompeting Feynman diagrams. We put all this vertex amplitude together and make a product with respect to all the vertices. For example, here there are only two vertices, so we just product them together. And summing over all the data, like spin and entwiner, of course, there's some weight here for the sum. And this is called spin form amplitude. And here is only an example of a simple vertex amplitude. One can have a more general, more complicated one with arbitrary valence. Here is only four valence, here arbitrary valence. And to define it, here is a concrete formula. So it's given by a trace of a number of entwiners associated with each edge. So that's the vertex amplitude. Recall that when we define spin form, so to each edge, there is a SU2 entwiner. But here, this entwiner entering this trace is not SU2 entwiner, but SL2C entwiner of spacetime. But this SL2C entwiner of spacetime is evolved from this spatial SU2 entwiner. And you can see the picture like that. There is a SU2 entwiner defining the quanta of space. And then we somehow propagate from spatial slice to the spacetime and by some way, and we get the SL2C spacetime entwiner. And for this kind of propagation from boundary to bulk, we describe using this Y map. There's Y map you can define. It's map from SU2 unitary irreducible representation to, with label J, to a SL2C unitary irreducible representation with two labels, there is a continuous label rho, taking value in real number, and also there's half integer discrete label m. And we ask the number of rho and m to be gamma times j and j. Gamma here to be the biveral image parameter. And here is concrete map from a spin state to a state in the unitary representation of SL2C. And then to construct this SL2C entwiner from SU2, we first apply this Y map to the SU2 entwiner. Then we apply some invariant projector to the SL2C invariant tensor space. So if you like, there's a concrete formula for this, this type of operation by using SL2C unitary irreducible representation matrix acting on SU2 entwiner. After one should do a group averaging to get an invariant tensor. So in this way, we plug this entwiner in this formula. We get the vertex amplitude. This is so-called EPRLFK vertex amplitude. It is first discovered by these people. And we use the same machine as before. We put all this vertex amplitude together, and we get the so-called spin form amplitude by make a product of all the vertex amplitude and summing over all the data, all the spins and entwiner, and we get the spin form amplitude. And this is called the EPRLFK spin form amplitude. And here there's some nice properties. So first of all, the sum amount of this state sum is finite. Although there is some gauge redundancy, which is SL2C gauge redundancy, but once we do some gauge fixing to remove this gauge redundancy, this object is finite, and the only divergence come to this spin form amplitude is given by the summing over J. So I will come back to this issue later to see how to remove this divergence. And secondly, also importantly, this spin form amplitude is manifestly Lorentz covariant. Okay, and let's review again the picture to construct the vertex, to construct spin form amplitude. Let's make analog with the quantum field theory scattering amplitude. And in quantum field theory, one of the elementary building blocks is this vertex amplitude. And what we need to do is just to glue those vertex amplitudes using propagator, and we construct the full scattering amplitude of particle. And here we have in spin form the vertex amplitude as the elementary building block. What we need to do is just to glue them, and like this, we get a complex, and we glue each of those vertices together, and then we get spin form amplitude. So which is our, the spin form is our quantum spacetime, and we get the quantum space-time is foam-like. Okay, so there are also other formulations, other equivalent formulations for spin foam amplitude, and they are corresponding to different factorization of the amplitude. And our previous defined amplitude is given by a factorization with respect to vertices. We can, of course, factorize amplitude using phase with phase. So we get this phase amplitude, which is nice because it's written by using SL2C character and SU2 characters. And also, we can factorize amplitude using edges. And here is the formulation. We get a product with respect to edge with some edge projector to the SL2Z intertwiner space. And also, we have a very useful the coherent state path integral. So we can write the spin foam amplitude as a path integral with some action here. And we will see later that this formulation is useful in semi-classical analysis. Also, there is also this holonomy spin foam model. And where we explicitly summing over J, we get some distributions on the group. And it turns out it's also useful in semi-classical analysis and study of continuum limit. And tomorrow, you will see more about this formulation in Frank Hellman's talk. And there's also, of course, the GFT formulation. And you have here a lot today already. It's another industry. And there's also the spinner-twister formulation you also hear today. And it seemed to me that this formulation is especially powerful in geometrical interpretations. OK, so many formulations, but where does it come from? And historically, maybe it's originally come from maybe 70s and 60s from Wheeler and Hawking, where this idea of quantum forms to describe quantum gravity. And the idea was because of Heisenberg uncertainty principle, there's in the short distance, there's a very high energy fluctuation, which you cannot control, and which may break the smoothness of, you will create a large curvature which breaks the smoothness of space-time. And then it's likely that our space-time in short distance is like that. And there's a lot of foam here. And the smooth space-time is replaced by a foamy space-time in short distance. And if we zoom out to the large scale, then the smooth space-time is somehow recovered. And such an idea is realized in 3D quantum gravity. And once we can write the first order path integral of 3D quantum gravity and compute it explicitly, which we get the so-called Pontano Regi model. And such a model describes somehow it's like a spin foam model and describe a foamy space-time where the elementary bubble is given by a tetrahedra. And also some idea come from the canonical loop quantum gravity where there's a Hamiltonian constraint operator defined by Thomas Tiemann. And it's acting on a spin network state to create edge there. And if we view the picture covariantly here, it creates foam and this vertex. And it is coming from the physical inner product by using the group averaging of this operator. And the message from this is that the spin foam amplitude here we are computing, it actually relates to the loop quantum gravity physical inner product. So there are also new progress about this direction made by these people. And also, there's more direct motivation for the spin foam amplitude I defined previously. So by using the covariant path integral, and here is the path integral of Lebesgue gravity, once we integrate out some Lagrangian multipliers, and we get some constrained BF theory as the path integral of gravity. And there's a simplicity constraint recovering the tetrad from B field and recovered Einstein, first order Einstein gravity. And if we remove the simplicity constraint and there's a BF theory, which can the partition function can be computed explicitly. And once we impose simplicity constraint to BF, we get the previously defined EPIL FK spin foam amplitude. And the imposition of the implement of simplicity constraint in this formulation has been also understood in many different ways recently by different techniques. OK, All right, so we talk a lot about formalisms and mathematics, so let's talk a bit about physics. So first, physics is what about elementary matter? So for quantum field, for quantum gravity theory, we have to study the interaction between gravitons and particles, other type of particles. So indeed, there's a formulation to describe that, and we have a concrete model coupling the Young-Mills field and fermions to the EPIL FK vertex to the EPIL FK spinform formulation. So that's the concrete model with the fermion and Young-Mills variables. And also there's also independent Young-Mills coupling for Baer-Crane model discovered in 2002. And I should admit that for the concrete properties of these models, the knowledge is still limited, and especially the study of semi-classical limit. But what we do know is some nice properties of spinform fermions. And first of all, the fermion correlators in spinform formulation can be written down as word lines on the fermion on the spinform spacetime. So it's like we should sum over all the passes on this foam-like spacetime, and with some exponential of discretized fermion word line action. And then this quantity is depending on the geometry, which is spins and entwiners of spinform. And then this quantity should be integrated in the spinform amplitude and to get the full fermion correlators. And then there's a nice property of fermion correlator, which is the spinform analog of PCT symmetry. And because there exists a spinform analog of PT conjugate, manifold PT conjugate spacetime with opposite time orientation, but keep the spacetime orientation invariant. Okay. What kind of action?
Yeah.
So it's a no, it's not word line formulation. Word line formulation is derived from some discretized fermion action. And then we have the PCT symmetry, which says that the complex conjugate of the fermion correlators on some spinform analog of spacetime is equal to the charge conjugated fermion correlators on the PT conjugate spacetime, which is analog the spinform analog of PT conjugated spacetime. So that's the analog of PCT symmetry in spinform context. Okay, so let's, one can ask the question, what about black holes? But I rather want to skip this part because there was a lot of talk yesterday by Alejandro and Eugenio. And also, there will be interesting talk by Mingyi Zhang about quantization of null surface in spinform formulation. So I rather skip this part. Let's talk about some cosmology. So is cosmology in the formulation? Indeed. So we have the model of cosmology. There's a simple model given by a simple spinform with a single spinform vertex. Okay, and this is somehow called a dipole approximation. And this dipole approximation means that it applies only when the curvature radius is much larger than the scale of the dipole. So the curvature radius of the spatial slice and the scale of the dipole here. Of course, and this is only a simple example, so the recent work have shown that one can generalize this to a more generic spatial spin network, so I rather take it as a simple example to illustrating the idea. So the input and the setting is like we have an incoming semi-classical state associated with this graph and outgoing semi-classical state for this graph, and they are semi-classical with some phase-based data, which is scale curvature and the time derivative of scale curvature, and they are semi-classically describing a homogeneous isotropic spatial geometry. And one can compute this spinform amplitude associated with this setting, and once we do some semi-classical analysis, and we find the amplitude is picked on the data satisfying this equation, which is nothing but the Friedmann equation when k equals 0 and without matter. And so there are more open questions how to go beyond dipole. and for example, also relate to loop quantum cosmology. They are implementing Hamiltonian constraints and path integral from loop quantum cosmology. And also it seems that the singularity is removed by recent work. And more questions, how about go beyond k equals zero, go beyond homogeneous isotropic, and with matter study inflations. That's something to be done in the future. And then the question, okay, is where is cosmological constant? And so that's an interesting question. So one, first of all, you can implement this cosmological constant in a simple model like this dipole cosmology, spinform cosmology model. One implemented, and one finds the spinform amplitude is picked on the modified Freeman equation with cosmological constant. So there's more interesting story to implement cosmological constant in full theory. And the idea is the cosmological constant is actually related to the quantum group structure in loop quantum gravity. So there are early works. Actually, the idea was first pointed out by Lee Smolin, and there was a lot of work on this direction. You see from the title, they studied the quantum deformation of quantum gravity. They studied the quantum deformation of spin networks, and they studied the relation with topological quantum field theory, and they all relate to cosmological constant. And the message from the from their work, the idea is the cosmological constant is actually related to the Q deformation in loop quantum gravity, and also relates to some boundary Chen-Simon theory. That time they call it Kodama state, and they all relate to infrared finiteness of the theory. And the idea was implemented recently in spinform setting in four dimensions, and the way to do it is just replacing the usual structure group in spin form by the corresponding quantum group. And there are two ways to do it. One replace the Lorentz group by Q deformed Lorentz group with Q with deformation parameter to be real. And another way in Euclidean signature, one replace the spin 4 group to be two copies of Q deformed SU2 with Q root of unity. And one can do the Q deformation of spin form amplitude. And one can write down the amplitude by factorization of vertex amplitude, and there's the phase amplitude. And it seems that I just put Q everywhere. But there is a non-trivial effect from this Q deformation, which results in a cutoff in the spin sum. And this cutoff is related to the inverse of cosmological constant. And as I said before, this the only divergence in spin form amplitude is coming from the summing over spins. And because of the quantum deformation, we get a finite spin form amplitude. And also, there's an interesting relation, deep relation between the quantum group structure and Chen-Simon theory. And for example, here we can consider a very general Chen-Simon theory with the complex gauge group. And here the Chen-Simon coupling may be complex, and which is K plus IIS. And this K should be integer in order that the quantum theory to be quantum Chen-Simon theory to be a gauge invariant. And because of this relation, we can have a Chen-Simon formulation of Q deformed spin form. So let's describe it briefly. So say there is two complex with several phases and several edges and several vertices. And we have a usual spin form amplitude on these two complex. And what we need to do to formulate in terms in the Chen-Simon formulation is that we imagine this complex in a 3D manifold rather than a 4D manifold, or we kind of project it, or because it's or combinatoric objects, we just say it's in a 3D manifold. And then we blow up all the vertices, and which means we remove all the vertices and put in some this kind of four simplex diagram here, and we demand that these curves here are 3D with line operators. So which means we get some kind of spin network function here on 3D. And then what we need to do is just put in the Chen-Simon theory, put this function into a 3D Chen-Simon theory, and we evaluate this gauge invariant function in the Chen-Simon theory. And here we say that the V-line operator is the holonomy of the 3D connection of Chen-Simon theory. And then we evaluate this function in the transaction theory, and we get some quantity, some numbers here, which is the Q-deformed spinform amplitude. And what we have here is the partition function, or this is the partition function of spinform, and we have the partition function of loop quantum gravity, Q-deformed loop quantum gravity in four-manifold, which is defined by Chern-Simon theory, Chern-Simon's evaluation of some spin network function on three dimensions, or in other way to say is that partition function of loop quantum gravity is equal to the partition function of Chern-Simon theory with line defect on three manifold. So then the question, what does it mean? So does it mean the Kodama state is supposed to be the ground state, natural ground state of loop quantum gravity, or the loop quantum gravity may come from the defects on three manifold? Or another question is how to count the number of degree of freedom in the quantum theory. So it seems because we formulate, in this reformulation, we formulate the partition function in terms of a 3D quantum field theory with defects. So the number of degree of freedom seems to be proportional to the area rather than the volume. And no matter how it means, so such a technique is very convenient for the semi-classical analysis for spin foams. And I will describe more semi-classics in the next part. So the result for the semi-classical analysis is that this partition function actually gives some exponential of the Einstein-Hilbert action or Einstein gravity, and with the cosmological constant. And this cosmological constant is proportional to the inverse of the Chern-Simons coupling. So that's the result. And the key point in this calculation is that whenever you have a crossing of this line defect in 3D, it corresponds to a cosmological constant term in four dimensions. And this crossing actually creates a full volume, and which is just the cosmological constant term in four dimensions. And then from that, there are some questions. So it seems that there is some non-trivial dynamical effect encoded from nodding and linking because of the crossing here. And another question is if we should enlarge the Hilbert space of loop quantum gravity to include those crossing and nodding, and or even QD form the Hilbert space. And there are a lot of work done for this direction, but we should understand more. So we have a lot of things so far, a lot of formalisms, a lot of results, but where is Einstein gravity? So because we are talking about quantum gravity here, so we better have Einstein gravity somewhere in the formalism. So it relates to the semi-classical analysis. So as we know, it's always hard to do semi-classical analysis in loop quantum gravity, so there are a lot of people working on this direction. And tomorrow you will see more details on this direction in Frank Hellman's talk. So here I only talk about it briefly. And in my opinion, the region to find Einstein is the following type of region. And let me describe it. So we should ask the area of each black hat in spin foam model should be much larger than the Planck scale, but much smaller than the four-dimensional curvature radius approximated by the spin foam. So actually, this is the analog in canonical quantum gravity in the semi-classicality of canonical loop quantum gravity. That time, they study the coherent state of loop quantum gravity. They study the semi-classical properties. It turns out that the coherent state should satisfy this type of property in order to have a good semi-classical behavior. But of course, that time this curvature to be it's a 3D curvature. And let me explain more about this relation. So the first part of this inequality is actually means semi-classical because it can be achieved by taking h bar goes to zero. And the second part actually means low energy, and because it means the wavelength of the gravitational fluctuation is much larger than the scale of the black hat. And to realize this inequality, one should define two scaling parameters. The first one is large spin, which implement the semi-classicality because spin is ratio of these two parameters. And the second one is the deficit angle, a small deficit angle, because the deficit angle is the ratio of these two. So to implement large spin, you will see more story in Frank's talk. And what we can do is, for example, using path integral formulation of a spin form, and there's a path integral with there's action for the spin form, first discovered by Thomas Takayevsky. And the, it turns out that so we can do the stationary phase for this path integral. It turns out the spin form critical data from this spin form action, it gives the simplicial geometry on the four manifold, on four dimensions. And not only simplicial geometry, but also some space-time orientation and even time orientation. And we can have a classification of critical data by using the, by using the geometry and orientations, and we have some order parameter which are taking different values on different types of data. And the most physical one is this critical configuration corresponding to Lorentzian geometry and with globally time-oriented. And for this type of data, we have a Lorentzian geometry and globally space-time oriented, also time-oriented. So the stationary phase approximation of this partial amplitude, which so temporarily we ignore summing over J for this partial amplitude, it gives the exponential of the radial action of gravity with some 1 over J corrections. So that's the result from large J approximation. And we can also consider the small deficit angle expansion. And the result is that in the large spin regime of this state sum, so recall that it's through summing over the spin form, it's summing over J. So in the regime that J is large, we can find the Einstein sector. So the partition, the spin form amplitude is gives approximately this functional integration of Einstein rigid gravity with some 1 over J correction and also some deficit angle correction. And here the deficit angle is actually the scale of the black hat times curvature, so it actually is some curvature corrections. And also interestingly, each deficit angle is participated with one bivariate image parameter. And actually what we get is the two parameter expansion from spin form amplitude from this approximation. So first of all, there's 1 over J correction, which means the quantum correction. And secondly, there's this A correction, or the deficit angle correction, and which are the high energy corrections, the curvature correction. And however, there's some subtleties for this perturbation theory, and because there exists some this type of terms, which is proportional to some power of deficit angle, but also proportional to some power of J, not inverse J. So it seems that this type of term is perturbative in A, but non-perturbative in 1 over J. And it seems that this perturbation theory is formal, but we can make it somehow rigorous. So by assuming that this type of term to be small, to be subleading. So such an assumption gives some restriction of deficit angle as J goes to large. And the precise restriction is given by that. The deficit angle should be much smaller than J to the power minus 1/2 and gamma to the power minus 1. So we get the following picture for the effective degree of freedom in the Einstein sector. And you can see there's a spike in this picture. And the red region is the effective degree of freedom, the effective degree of freedom for the fluctuation of the deficit angle. And the Einstein rigid gravity is living in this red region. And you can see the whites of this spike is given by the bound I gave previously. And there is some interesting regime that, and so for this part of the regime, there's no restriction for the deficit angle, but this part of this part only appear when we assume the bivariate Ebing's parameter is small. This somehow relates to the previous calculation of graviton endpoint functions, and where they always assume the bivariate Ebing's parameter is small. And there's another interesting regime here. So you see that when J goes to really large and the deficit angle is so restricted, such that there's only flat solution is allowed. Only flat solution can be allowed. And such a flatness, you will hear more about this flatness in Frank Hellman's talk. It relates to lots of discussions. And however, there's a question that, is there physical here? Is there physical or semi-classical in this regime? So we know that J in loop quantum gravity is the scale of the area, or actually the scale of the discrete structure in spin foam setting. So when J goes too large, it seems that we are living on this type of space-time. There are a lot of holes around us, and we are living, and we are here. And we are on a big frame, and it seems not real. Okay, and some a bit more serious stuff. And we can, from the perturbation theory, and we can even go beyond a bit the Einstein sector, where we get this type of parallel universe, the infinite tower of spikes. And we can actually, these are the effect degree of freedom where go beyond the Einstein sector, and here is the Einstein sector in the k equals zero branch. And we can also go even more beyond, consider different orientations or even topological sector, and this is something to be done. So what do we have so far? And so we have, first of all, a non-perturbative formulation, which is finite, and it relates some 3D gauge theory with defect. And we also have a perturbative formulation derived from non-perturbative formulation, and which is a two-parameter expansion, and like that. And leading order gives Einstein gravity. And from that, we see there is some curvature correction which modify the UV behavior of Einstein gravity. And I think it is now time to see, to study the UV completion of quantum gravity by using spin foam techniques. And also from the perturbation theory, there is maybe a way to find the continuum limit in spin foams. And also, there are more open questions. How about semi-classical low energy effective theory? Actually, the previous perturbation theory is aiming at that. And there should be more understanding of Chen-Simon formulation. And of course, one should study the observable consequences, study cosmology, particle physics, to get quantum gravity corrections to high energy physics. And there may be one should do a top-down approach to black hole physics, and there will be more. So I think I stop here. Thank you.
Thank you. I would like if you could come back to the picture where there was a tentative dot called us on the spin foam. Yeah, here, this picture. I think it goes right to one of the debates that we have, namely, suppose we are there, and it looks like then we should look for the discreteness or the boundaries of this tetrahedron as in the very large distance. Like, we are a small dot, and this could be, I don't know, astrophysics, domain-wise or so. I think it goes right to the question of whether we should express this as infrared or ultraviolet effect. And there's also, in string theory, for instance, the possibility of a duality between these points of view, but I don't see there is one there. So what is your point of view on this?
Yeah, I roughly agree with you, but I would say phenomenologically, I would like to make a cutoff here, just to completely remove this region, and by using, for example, quantum group, because, I mean, this quantum group parameter, although it relates to cosmological constant, but it's not the real cosmological constant. It's a bare cosmological constant. It can be very large. So it's well-defined to put a cosmological constant here and make a cutoff. That's maybe the simplest way to do it. But of course, like what you said, one can do more, because it seemed to me that the physics probably living here, which is small deficit angle and also small area, relatively small area. Maybe that is the regime where it relates to the GFT or phase transition or something like that. I don't know.
OK, Okay, thanks for a very nice review of this subject. My question, I'm going back to the fermions, UV and IR physics. So as you know, in the real world, right, in the standard model, we have chiral fermions.
Okay.
So we have to worry both about gauge anomalies, but we also have to worry about gravitational anomalies.
Mm-hmm.
And so there should be both the UV aspect of this and the IR aspect. Right?
Okay.
From the effective field theory point of view. So what's the what do we learn about the anomalies? If you put a chiral fermion, let's say to a spin foam, you get some consistency.
Yeah, we thought about it first of all, and of course the concrete result is hard to study, but let's say what is already being studied. So one study is the fermions coupled to Regi calculus. That's maybe a baby version for that. One study it. So one do the computer simulation to study the fermion propagators on the Regi lattice. And one find it's very similar to the situation of random lattice, and where there's a suppression of the doubler, which means that in that approximation, it's OK in the Regi calculus, in some model of Regi calculus, not actually not the full Regi calculus. Yes, but I mean, suppose suppose this spin foam is following in the semi-classical regime, following the Regi calculus in that result, then the doubler suppress. So where you can get the usual gravitational anomalies, where supposed to be there.
Yeah, just a comment leading to a question about this infrared versus ultraviolet. Unlike Yang-Mills theory, which is weakly coupled and asymptotically free at short distances and strongly coupled at long distances, the one thing we know about gravity is that it's extremely weakly coupled at long distances. At the cosmological constant scale, which is the natural scale, it's extremely weakly coupled. Is that naturally come out of the approximations and the expansions that you're talking about?
Seems not. The approximation, the expansion we have studied is rather weak coupling, only the weak coupling expansion.
No, I'm right. But if that's consistent, as large as that is, or as large on the information of the large
Yes, I mean this is what we got in the perturbation theory. This is what we got in perturbation theory. But in the strong coupling regime, I don't know anything from the perturbation, from the result.
Right. So your perturbation theory is a correct perturbation.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's consistent with that. Yes.
Why is it so weak compared to, let's say, because the ratio, the dimensionless constant, which is the topological constant in quantum units, is 10 to the minus 120 is 15 small.
Okay, So thank you again for this very nice talk. If I were a quantum field theorist, like for example, people who do rigorous quantum field theory, they always ask this question, right? They said, okay, so what you have done is the analog of putting Yang-Mills theory on a lattice or some other contracting theory on a lattice. And yes, with quantum group, you have done something nice, showing infrared niceness. The fact that you put it on a lattice is, I mean, there's not such a big surprise that you've got ultraviolet finiteness on thing. And the all non-trivial thing is in the continuum limit, right? So throughout your talk, you had sort of fixed one spin form, and we're doing just one with one spin form. That is like fixing a lattice and doing everything that lattice.
Yeah.
So they would say that we're not really addressing the real problem of quantum field theory, which is, in usual quantum field theory, it might be continuum limit. Here it might be the sum over all the, and they expect that in that solving that real problem, all the technical and physical non-trivialities lie. So what is your response to such a criticism?
Okay, so I should go to the really. So first of all, of course, everything we've done is discrete. Actually, and that's one of the main technical difficulties to develop, for example, this type of perturbation theory. But here, what we have is it's some structural of the perturbation theory. We already see here there's the leading order Einstein gravity, but there is some UV correction. I mean, it modifies the UV behavior of spin form, modifies Einstein gravity. So that's what we have seen. Yeah, it's on a fixed spin form. So from that, we have seen that. And also, of course, one should study the continuum limit. Then ask the question that in the textbook, is there any successful results, successful stories we can take to study continuum limit? And one open textbook and find the successful result is lattice gauge theory and perturbative lattice gauge theory. The perturbative lattice perturbation theory, that there one can find, do the perturbation theory of Yang-Mills on the lattice and expand it, there are infinite tower of high order interactions. One study the Feynman diagrams and so on, and find, do the renormalization scheme for the infinite tower of perturbation theory, and then we find the in the continuum limit, one gets the continuum limit from that, and one have the continuum limit, which is the usual Yang-Mills interaction on the continuum. So, okay, it seemed to me then the perturbation theory may be the most powerful tool here, the most immediate powerful tool is in studying the continuum limit. And it seems this is perhaps one should, that's why I mentioned continuum limit here. It seems maybe because, I mean, the usual continuum limit, the difficulty of continuum limit is basically interchanging the continuum limit and the quantization in the path integral. But however, when we do perturbation theory, one get the effective action order by order, somehow we get the theory and make quantum correction order by order, so we can take immediately the continuum limit, which is A equals to zero. And A, this scale, usually disappear in full loop quantum gravity, but it appear here. And because we do semi-classical analysis, we have a, so basically here we somehow destroy a bit of the background independent by putting in by perturbative expansion around some critical spin form data. And so we get a natural scale there, and so which we can somehow we can control. So that's my.
After we thank the speaker, the session will be considered closed, and Lee will give an announcement. So let us thank.